Good evening, comrades. You are in tune to Poet Radio, September 2019 edition. My name is Chris, the host of the program. I'm really glad to have on the program this evening an old friend, a good friend, and a teacher of mine, Don Bird, who for many years was a professor at the University of Albany, also known as SUNY Albany, in the English department. And Don's research originated in he's a student of Ed Dorn's, and he wrote a phenomenal book on Charles Olson's Maximus. By the time I met Don, he moved on and was exploring all the creative potentials for cyberspace and electronic writing, and that was actually the thing that brought me to the Hudson Valley, upstate New York, Capital District in the first place. And Don, great to be with you.
It's good. Yeah, I mean, how long has it been? It's been 25 years.
It's about time we got on the radio together. I'm very excited to hear some of your writing, which is poetry and prose, whatever you brought to the table here. But one of the things that came up in our conversation a few minutes ago is that you have not been publishing a lot over the past couple of decades.
I've hardly published at all, actually. The three or four pieces that I've published were outliers from what I normally do or what I was thinking about primarily doing. The piece that I guess I recently did that I would mention is an introduction to Ed Sanders' book, Investigative Poetics.
That's right. That's an excellent piece.
Wonderful to have that book back in print and in a nice edition. And I would highly recommend it. I think that, it seemed to me that what needed to be done was that book, which was written a very long time ago, is still relevant in ways that were perhaps not entirely clear. And so I tried to write an introduction trying to say why it still is something that really is essential, not just something that one can take a look at or something like that, but it's really something that everyone really should know.
Well, the poet as an investigator, the poet is required to do research. Sanders writes a nice blueprint of
archive went on for sale, and there was something like 500 library boxes full of materials that he had collected over the years, because everything he would see that struck him as strange or interesting or questionable, or he would start collecting everything he could about it, and had a building full of file cabinets.
You haven't been publishing, but you've sent me recently in the emails also that are great pieces of writing, and eventually
I certainly didn't stop writing.
Right.
I mean,
right. That's what I was getting to.
Well, actually, when we were talking about this, you were at my 50th birthday party. I just published The Poetics of the Common Knowledge, which is the last major piece I published. This was 25 years ago. I was really interested in finding another way to go forward. I felt like I'd come to a particular kind of end. And in fact, I'll read a little bit from the very end of that book.
Poetics of the Common Knowledge.
Poetics of the Common Knowledge, 1996 it was published. Now there are no examples. This is difficult to say. The statement itself wants to become an example of something, a world or an epic, especially an example of words, which in turn want to become examples of phonemes, significant differences, statistical reliabilities, or examples of now. Words, however, are not examples of words. Now is not an example of now. From now to now, word to word, is a precise measure, unexemplary, unrepresentable except by the traces which mark it, unrepeatable. The design we cut in time happens once and once only. There are no examples here, now. And when you arrive at that point, after spending one's life dealing with metaphors, allegories, archetypes that got repeated in various kinds of ways as ways of creating an entire world, I'd been in a world in which everything was an example of everything else. The fundamental doctrine of Western philosophy from the Greeks is that e pluribus unum, everything is one. From the one come many. It was known as the problem of the one and the many in philosophy for 2,500 years. And what that means, of course, is that everything is an example of the one. And in some sense, since everything is contained in the one, everything is equal to everything else. And the entire history of our art and our philosophy and our science and our mathematics has been an attempt to work out those exemplary relationships between the great one thing, which is nature or God or self or various metonymies, metonymy being another kind of example, metonymies of totality. So suddenly to realize that one lives in a condition in which at most examples are tools of something rather than connections in a real world that somehow bind you. Because if you start dealing with one example, if A is B, an example of B, that becomes not just a fact, but it becomes a kind of law that if you are going to say anything else, it needs to be consistent with A is B in some way.
But now A is A and B is B and...
Well, yeah, and yeah, right, and there you are. And if you...
I finally understand the conclusion of your book, Don.
And then what you do, you shut up, right? I mean, that would be the first thing to do.
But that's like this is a dystopic perspective, yeah?
It was. I mean, I'm dystopic understanding of the civilization that I grew up in, which was crazy. I decided when I was a teenager that grown-ups were crazy. I'm 75 years old now, and I found no reason to think I was wrong. I became a part of that world, too, of that crazy world. But, you know, the doctrine of mutual assured destruction is crazy. That if you live your life, as I lived a big part of my life, first part of my life, first 50 years of my life, under the circumstance that if some other country in some other part of the world that you know nothing about does something that your country does not like, you're going to blow them the hell up, and they're going to blow you the hell up.
Mm.
That's crazy. Because right. The idea was that, okay, since we were going to blow one another up, neither one of us will do that. People forget about the bombs, but they're still there, enough of them, plenty to blow up the world as a whole.
Many times over.
Many times
That's
over.
That's true.
And the interesting thing is that the writing that I'd been doing for the first 50 years of my life, going right back to high school, always had a way of coming to a particular end. The way the Poetics of Common Knowledge comes to an end that really doesn't have any way to go on. That seemed to me a better alternative than going on by having this crazy agreement that we're not going to blow up one another because we are going to blow up one another, which is basically the logic that Dr. Strangelove was based on.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I lived in Dr. Strangelove's world.
Right. So your book is not an example of anything.
Well, it comes to the point where it realizes that it cannot be an example of anything. It tries very hard for almost 400 pages to be an example of poetry, to be an example of the universe, to be an example of a possible government, to take a set of ideas and to come to a way to try to understand the world in terms of those basic relationships. I mean, I thought that the path I'd been on, and it began by really becoming deeply involved with a set of very forceful poets. I don't know that if one would be 17 now and would start looking for poets that would completely seem to be adequate to propose an entire way of life. I don't know whether you'd find them or not. But when you could find Allen Ginsberg and Gary Snyder and Jack Kerouac and Charles Olson and Robert Duncan and John Ashbery and O'Hara, I mean, on and on. There were, if you pick up the Poetics of the New American Poetry, these weren't just kind of poets who were kind of minor. These were major, major people who had absolutely compelling visions of the way the world was. And I particularly fell for that vision as it was kind of divided up between Charles Olson and Robert Duncan. Had the opportunity not only to study with Ed Dorn, but also Robert Duncan, and became friends of Robert Duncan's, and, you know, we saw a lot of one another over the rest of Duncan's life. And these were people who, in another mode, might have been cult leaders. They had that kind of charisma and that kind of totality about them.
Personalities.
Yes. Ed and Robert were very different in their personalities and the way their charisma was expressed. That is to say, Dorn didn't talk very much and Robert Duncan talked all the time.
Mm-hmm. Going back to this idea that being 17-year-old now, mm-hmm. whether or not someone's going to tune in to the literary arts in a profound way, I'm not ready to give up on that yet, because from what I can see, people are still looking for something. And there's actually maybe a small percentage of youth are looking beyond their phones for that thing. And sometimes that comes out and turns out to be a focus on, you know, the arts of one form or another.
I don't deny that at all. I mean, in fact, I don't think the phone necessarily is a problem. I think the phone might, in fact, be exactly the place where it might happen.
Well, people could start to think about the phone as being a muse, M-U-S-E. Some corners might be turned. Well, people are titillated by their phones. But now to put some content on there to not just be a consumer on your phone, but to be a producer, that's the great leap.
I think. Well, I think this is basically the dead end that I came to. And I kept coming to this dead end for years before I finished Poetics of the Common Knowledge. And that is that it's not only not being a consumer, but it may also not be a matter of finding the right content. I mean, in some ways, what the Poetics of the Common Knowledge and the Great Dime Store Centennial, the long book of poems that I wrote, propose is that what's important there is not the content, but in fact the act of being engaged with a world that you address by way of certain content, perhaps get to it by way of certain content. But it seems to me that 500 years is a very long time for any cultural movement, and we've been had literacy for over 500 years at this point.
And for something new.
The alphabet is a very tired and ancient form. And as a matter of fact, we're getting very close to where the phone with a small screen and voice recognition can maybe do away with the alphabet altogether.
Yeah, there you go.
Would mean that we'd no longer have that distance. And I mean, look at the alphabet. The alphabet is nonsense. It has absolutely nothing to do with anything except this stuff that it takes you many, many years to drill into your head and to get good at it, to get as good at it as, you know, one needs to be to read the poetry that I was reading when I was 25. It takes your entire life up to that time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I would be interested in would be a kind of education, and it seems to me that the whole educational system stands very much in the way of this kind of change, too. I mean, I spent 42 years as a university professor, and I think, in all honesty, maybe I didn't do a lot of damage. I chose to study English and become a university professor instead of becoming an electrical engineer, because I knew that being an electrical engineer, I would end up probably working for the military. And I didn't want to do that. And I probably didn't do as much damage by being an English professor as I would have being an engineer, an electrical engineer. Because I spent my entire youth actually doing electronics. I mean, that was really, I was an amateur radio operator, and I had a radio station, shortwave radio station of my own. I built, much of which I built from scratch.
That's right. I forgot about that.
One thing that's been constant in my life are great nests of wires. If you look behind my monitors here, you see this great nest of wires.
Yeah.
And I've lived with that literally since I was a teenager, a young teenager. I started doing this when I was 13 or 14. I lived in a, you know, kind of ordinary suburban three-bedroom ranch house. And there behind the carport, there was a room that was made primarily, I think, for having the lawnmower. But that was my shop. It was a tangle of wires as soon as you walk through the door. And one of the things that's behind the Poetics of the Common Knowledge is the fact that I learned to actually not only how an oscillator worked, but to build them. I mean, an oscillator is an amazing thing, is that how do you get a radio signal started? You want to have a radio signal. Where do you get it? You just reach up in the air and grab it or something. But there's this very complicated circuit in which you take what we now call and think, I mean, everybody knows about amplifiers. But basically radio signals start as feedback. What you do is you take an amplifier and you take the output and you feed it back into itself. But where do you get the thing that you feed back? And one of the great mysteries of electronic circuitry is that the thing that starts out, the electromagnetic signal that you want to send out there. I send it out first as Morse code. So you just have a signal and you turn it off and on. That's simple enough. But you still got to capture that first signal somehow. And then you can keep running it back through your system again and again and again. And those signals that I sent out when I was 14.
They're still going.
They're out there.
Somewhere.
Yeah, 60 light years away. Just hoping to find someone who will recognize my call signal, which was K0HHG.
You never know.
And
I'm glad that you mentioned the Great Dime Store Centennial. I want to try to pull this back into a little poetry.
Yeah.
Maybe you could do the things in whatever order you wish. If you have, say, later poems that are addressing some of these things, that's great. And if you think maybe the Great Dime Store Centennial was published in 1986,
right?
I think.
The real point about all this work, and this includes work back to, I mean, these are the two books I would want to stake myself on. But, you know, there are two other books before them, Book of Poems, Book of Criticism. And the thing is that in all of them and in all of the other kind of more traditional kinds of writing that I've done, they are exactly the opposite in some ways of an oscillator. And that is that it's easy enough to get a book started, but how do you stop it without it just stopping everything? And that's basically what I find happens in writing. If you really follow it to the end, you run out, and that's it. That's where you came to. And near the end of the Great Dime Store Centennial, it says this. Jamais vu. I've never seen this before. The cosmos of repetition always belonged to someone else, possibly a committee. How do you make a robot more than an adding machine? Supply it with the philosophy, preferably one expressed as a riff to improvise on. I'll write it up. I am at home and not at home. You can tell the liar's paradox is in effect. The music, the liar divided into parts. By Wednesday, it sounded like sand blown against plate glass. I'm going to speak, and then not to speak. And in the space between these events, it will rain. I announce the end of human mindedness. Complete stop.
That's visionary, right? I mean, not only for yourself and what you're talking about, but here in this, you know, kind of insane world we live in now, we got to that.
I should have stopped right there, actually. I went on another 20 pages. And in fact, it does end with an apocalyptic vision, which I think is really the serious flaw in the book, that I kind of copped out rather than facing up to the fact that one is just there in that kind of way. Maybe I can read a little bit of that, I guess. It actually ends in a disco, in a great party. The DJ once more nudges the turntable to a faster pace and higher pitch, mixing record after record so that each is a little faster, higher in pitch and more intense, urging the dancers toward frenzy. Cries and calls and 1,000 arms waving in the air, and as the music lifts the dancers off their feet and off the floor, the word in roller disco is flying. The beat goes on, harder, faster, crazier, and all at once fountains of smoke pour from the ceiling. A misty fog begins to rise from the floor. Cyanide gas. I think of being able to take off my skin and dance around in my bones. The word for this feeling in roller disco is flying. Complete stop. But then it goes on and kind of caps out and has this nice little cricket at the end, cricketing. But anyway, as that's I say, right. I should have ended it with complete stop. But
it's nice to hear the poems, and I think in the end the poem, you know, holds up well. I can understand why you would maybe want to document all of it, but it still has like a relevance.
Well, it's not really that I don't want to document it. It's literally the physical fact I don't want to read it all out loud. I mean, that's
a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, and I mean, I just find that I, you know, reading short shots I enjoy. But
so we've gone and we've looked and we've heard excerpts from the end of your two most recent books, but maybe we should turn to some of the unpublished writing and.
Okay.
And see how that compares.
Here's a poem.
I just wanted to remind listeners that they're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson.
This is a poem I wrote 2 or 3 years ago. I was asked to give a talk about Charles Olson in Gloucester, Massachusetts, which was Olson's home. And I thought about talking about giving a lecture. I was thinking very much about mathematics at the time. And Olson was a poet for whom mathematics was a deep and serious study. I mean, if you look at his archive, you find books, serious textbooks of topology and non-Euclidean geometry, which are heavily read and marked. And he talks about this in his writing, about the way in which the change in space that took place about 1830 is reflected actually in the prose style of Moby Dick and Herman Melville, and that the idea of space is the central fact, he says, to man born in America. He wrote a book about Melville called Call Me Ishmael, and it begins, I take it that space is the central fact to man born in America. So anyway, I was going to talk about that, and then I realized, oh, I don't really want to do that. And again, I don't like to write to read long lectures either. I like to talk, and when I write something, I think, well, I wrote that for someone to read it, and when I talk, I want to talk. Anyway, I decided, no, I'm not going to lecture about
space
and mathematics and Olson. And so I wrote a poem to read in the place of a lecture about Charles Olson and mathematics. Nice short poem. About 1930, people began to think, not about things, but about what they did to things. They did something to something, and then they did something to the thing they did, and did something to that. Space changed. Lobachevsky and space changed again. Riemann, Moby Dick, won. Galois, the thing they did to the thing they did can be called the hand of infinity between the thing and the thing done to the thing done. Thus, one counted, one, two, three, oom-pa-pa, oom-pa-pa. It was waltz time. You take the thing, you do something to it, you do something else to it, oom-pa-pa, oom-pa-pa, one, two, three. Herman Melville and Albert Einstein were cosmic waltzers, oom-pa-pa. It looked like Moby Dick had won. It looked like Andrew Jackson had won. It looked like Bertrand Russell had won and Harry Truman had won. Time ran away. Oom-pa-pa. The world had no shape. What you did had only the shape that was its shape. But what you did to what you did to what you did to you, this, oom-pa-pa, was still to be found out. As the neoplasms arrived from the future, without genetic baggage or known appetites, the neoplasm stepped forth on Earth, and time whistled around their ears like small, beautiful birds. Birds of red and gold never seen before. We know how to count to three and contain the world therein, the entire world therein, between a one and a three. Gravelly Hill, Dogtown, and the Hesiodic cosmos. But the red and gold birds were strange, and the dipole of their song stretched to paradise. This was 1963. We knew how to count to three and stop, but we counted to two forever. Time and the birds were two, and strange, the cause for melancholy in creation and space and time. This was 1969. In 1969, speciation held. The speciated people sang in the sunshine. The other people attended this lecture. What we do with what we do to what we did is still to be found out. 1963 was when Olson published the first the book of the first two volumes of the Maximus mm-hmm. poems, and in 1969 was just before he died, so it was the period after the first real book of the Maximus poems. And So that's when the speciation ended. But the people who were at the lecture, we don't know what happened to us. I mean, 69 was, in some sense, the end of it.
I don't know if you ever read Eileen Myles' book, 1969. And she declares that that was the end of America for her. Hendrix mm-hmm. playing at Woodstock, yeah. That was the end. I mean, it's a beautiful passage about why, you know, this symbolized the end.
And they had Sanders' book in 1968, so just before that.
Yeah, we managed to trot on, you know, for decades.
Well, I don't think we did, actually. I really think that was the end, the spiritual end of the country. And, I mean, there'd certainly been abundant reason to believe that things were not going particularly well before that. Mm. But it was really with the death of Jimi Hendrix and the breaking up of the Beatles and all that was one arc of what happened. It was certainly not the only one by any means. But it was also about that time that the technological changes that had been devoted entirely to wartime kinds of things in during World War II. I mean, there was this huge outburst of technological innovation as a result of the war. I mean, the bomb itself. They didn't have computers. One of the people involved in the Los Alamos, which, and I'm not thinking right now which one of them it was, but the story is, and I have, this has been reported repeatedly by all of these solemn physicists, that when they needed serious calculations to be done, there was one of them who could go into a kind of trance and do the calculations that they needed to build a bomb. Which I wish I could think of which one it was. But one of the famous people involved in
So it's an interesting situation. If you declare the end of the spiritual life of the country, but not this, but the spiritual life of at least some of the population continues, then you have somewhat of a conundrum.
Oh,
like a internal, external. I mean, how do we deal with identity? At that point?
Spiritual is probably the wrong word for one thing. I
But I know what you mean. I think someone could say that, and you go, okay, yeah, Vietnam dragged on. There was lies. There's endless political corruption and it's like BS. The economy.
Certainly, though, Vietnam was part of it. The fact that the solutions that we thought were going to really work. I mean, in the late 60s. By the early 70s, it happened very quickly, was over. Not that there was any conspiracy or anything, but that the real idea that people could be free, that people could have lives of pleasure and joy rather than lives of hard work and all that kind of stuff, that finally bubbled up. It's really... an original idea of what it might mean to have a free country. It really began to wear out, and you begin to see that this was the beginning of all of those devices that seemed like they might be possible ways of freedom were being turned to the opposite, and that the technological possibilities that made, say, Jimi Hendrix's guitar possible. I mean, it was a major technological event. I mean, that feedback that is the absolute nature of Hendrix's guitar is basically the auditory version of what happens when you do a radio signal. I mean, you get that guitar pick up in front of the speakers, and it starts hearing that, hearing the guitar. It's not hearing the sound of the guitar, hearing the electronic vibrations coming off of the pickup.
Right, right. Well, that's a nice thing to come back to with regard to what you were saying before, for sure.
Yeah. And I remember sometime in 73, 74, when I first got to Albany, there were all these young, exciting students. And, I was 27, at the time. So they were 10 years younger than me or less. And, teaching was absolutely a joy. I mean, strangely enough, another side of the story actually is that being a part of the Cold War, America took seriously the idea that they had to include people like me. And in fact, I went through graduate school. I went through school as a kind of project of the Cold War. My graduate school education was sponsored by something called the National Defense Education Act, Title IV Fellowship, which paid me handsomely at the time to be a graduate student and to study wild and crazy poetry. And someone down deep in the United States government knew they were doing that.
Well, they had lots more money for the arts. And
sure, there was money for the arts. I mean, it started out that the National Defense Education Act was for engineers and scientists. But they realized that if we're going to make good on the notion of liberal democracy that we're trying to put up against the communism, I mean, we've got to have something that they don't have. And even though obviously there were still certain fragments of McCarthyism and that kind of thing, and anti-hippieism and anti-underground art business around, I mean, you would walk around with long hair and a beard, and people would yell at you and tell you to leave, as people now get told to leave, except all you had to do was to be a white kid with long red curly hair, But still, I was sponsored to not just to teach in a university, but it was perfectly okay that I would teach revolutionary, wild, strange, sexy literature.
Well, that still happens now.
It still happens, but let me tell you my story. By 63 or 64, the students who were there to hear what I wanted to say weren't there anymore. or most of them weren't. I mean, it happened overnight. You know, the younger brothers and sisters of the generation that I first ran into there, they had been frightened away. And I went came home and said to Marge, my wife.
In 63 or 64, wait.
No, I mean, 70, 73 or 74.
Okay. Sorry.
I was back in the poem here.
Time warp.
Yeah. The 63 and 64 is, I think, the moments in which what I was experiencing later, you know, actually happened. Mm. And that's the deep structure of it. But anyway, I came home and I said to Marge, you know, look, I was trained to, you know, educate a bunch of dope-crazed young hippies, and I've lost my constituency. They're not there anymore. You know, to be sure, there continued to be, happily, I mean, every year. But, you know, that was the pits. That was the worst year. You know, but then gradually, you know, I'd pick up a few students, and I, you know, I always had, for 40 years, I had people to talk to, which was wonderful in many ways. I certainly still miss the graduate students that I had to talk to. I mean, you know, there were people like you coming along and, you know.
Causing trouble.
I'd say, here, look at this. You know, you had
a captive audience, Don.
Yeah, I had a captive audience. And, you know, I told you, you know, look, you can do this and you can go out and get a job like mine and you can cause the kind of trouble I cause.
Yeah, I don't know how possible it is. It's a very small percentage of people who can do that now.
Oh, I don't know that there's anyone who can get themselves into the position to do that and still have the kind of troublemaking interests that I seem to have managed to hold on to somehow.
Well, even though you had this sort of bleak intellectual philosophical view, you tried hard. I mean, you did.
Oh, I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm.
I mean, you were. You held on to some ideals. You did.
Inspire.
I mean, you did fire us up.
I mean, it's not a matter that I had a wonderful life. I mean, I'm not complaining. The fact is that, you know, I wanted to turn the English department at SUNY Albany into Black Mountain College.
Noble idea.
And I got close a couple of times, almost destroyed the place at least once. You know, and the battle was good. I mean, it was not that I was there moping and everything. I mean, you know, what you say to your wife when you come home from work is one thing.
Right,
what you say when you go back the next morning is something else.
Well, you have to find a way to survive.
Well, yeah, and in the early 70s, this moment that I speak of here, where there was this split, and the other people who attended this lecture, you know, I mean, it was literally, I really like the turn at the end of this where I get to just, it's us, right?
That's the punch, the poem.
The other people who attended this lecture, what we do with what we did to what we did is still to be found out. I mean, that's not unhopeful.
No, that's true. That is much more of a uplifting vision. I mean, of there might be something.
Well, I mean, you know,
I think there might be. It's hard to imagine what it's going to take. I mean, what kind of human catastrophe it's going to take to pull us out of it. I mean, I always thought it'd be great if somehow we could just be humbled a little bit more. Say we weren't at the top of the food chain, for example, then we'd have a different ontology, a different approach to how we handle capitalism and stuff like so. All of a sudden, if you know some gigantic, you know, giant alien creature came down or something, that might do it. But as it turns out, it's
we are the aliens. It turns out
you're probably right about that. But some of these aliens are pretty effing evil, and they happen to have the so-called power. So
I've never been terribly optimistic about the United States. I mean, and, you know, when people tell me to leave, I mean, I literally do not know anything about any of my grandfather's and grandmother's families except as people who lived in this country. When they tell me to go back home, it would be to leave Missouri and go to North Carolina, maybe, or something like that. We're in deep trouble, deep and serious trouble, and we're not going to get out of it easily. I'll be fine. I'm 75. I really, you know, we're going to hang around as long as I can to see what happens. But I have a 9-year-old granddaughter. And I worry about the kids. It's going to be a miserable century. There's no way I can see to avoid it. There are going to be a lot of people die off. Maybe billions of people, you know, maybe half the population of the earth. And if we're going to have an art at this point, it needs to be an art that I think faces that as the reality. Mm. Mm. So anyway, what I started doing in 1994 was to try to, I wasn't this bleak at that point. I thought what we'd done had failed, but I mean, you know, Bill Clinton didn't look too bad. Anyway, so I started out a book, and I wrote a book, an entire book, with the character of a DJ. I wrote a book under the pseudonym DJ Juicy Decibels.
You wrote a book, but it's not. This isn't a
published book. It wasn't a published book. And
it's poems.
No, it was prose actually.
Uh-huh. At first, I heard of it, Don.
I used it. What this did was it freed me from Professor Byrd, and it let me to write as the guy that was, you know, the DJ at the end of the Great Dinosaur Centennial. Sure. So it let me say all these crazy things that I couldn't say as Professor Byrd, or I didn't think I could say. And as a matter of fact, as it turned out, I didn't have the way to say them, because after writing a dissertation and two academic books, one of them very, very long and broadly based, you internalize the academic sentence and paragraph absolutely. And so DJ Juicy Decibels freed me from that to some extent. And then gradually I began to be more and more comfortable with the things that Juicy was saying.
Was there any relation between Juicy and thus Albert and Hubert?
No, Albert and Hubert were actually more important, because Juicy was just one person, and Albert and Hubert were 2 or 7 or 30 or something people.
This is another, thus Albert and Hubert was another nom de plume of Don, and a short-lived but excellent publication we worked on together, another friend or two, called Descriptions of an Imaginary Universe. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead. I mean, I needed to, that certainly is relevant and needs to be, certainly I would have been happy if somehow, not necessarily that particular installation of our collaboration would have gone on, but some version of it, I would have certainly been.
We're trying to kickstart a new one, I believe.
Well, let's do it. I mean, I'm... I have a page of Albert Hubert open before me here.
Oh, good.
Short paragraph is, to be sure, attention requires immense exertion. It is, however, a possible discipline, not an impossible one. It is okay to scream, but listen to the sound you make.
Very good. That's right. Of course, you can't just be on a soapbox and not pay attention to.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what you're and particularly saying. If you're, what you're saying is babble, which is most all of the things that are going to make sense now are going to begin as babble or something close to it.
Unfortunately, true in the mass media, not always true in the literary arts.
Well. I think I would see that just the opposite.
Is that right?
Yeah. That actually the mass media makes intense sense.
well,
Well, no, I mean, it makes sense in terms of the very life that we lead, and that people's lives are created by that media, and they are defensive of it, and intensely so. I mean, people are willing to go and...
You know, earlier you were talking, when we were talking about the, you know, there are no examples, you were talking about the act over the content. I mean, how the act is privileged. See, this is where I don't see the flip of that.
Well, I mean, the most, one of the most intense examples of speech act that we, of act that we have going on now is, Or the tweets of the president.
Yeah, if you pay attention to them.
You don't even have to pay attention to them. They inform your life one way or another. And they will. They will inform your life one way or another. There's no avoiding it, actually.
I think that you're probably right about that, but it's nice to have this illusion of not being tuned in. We have no cable TV, for instance. I don't get the effusive babble of
that means that it's even more insidious because you're getting it without knowing it.
I know, from people I pass by on the street.
You know, and people you pass by on the street, by the way, people carry their bodies when you pass them on the street, and the way we all carry our bodies, whether we know about what's going on or not, because we know something is going on, and that it we tense up all the time in the face of it. And,
well, there may be ways to try to curb
that. By the way, I don't know how much time we have, but I do have an answer if that I want to be able to say
an answer to
what to do.
Oh, what to do? Well, Don, it is great to talk with you. We have had a tremendous conversation, but I think I would like to devote the rest of our session together, however long you would like to take it, in hearing some of your written, spoken.
No, I mean, I have this written down again. One thing I should say is since 1994, I've probably written 4,000 or 5,000 pages.
Hey. Wow. Yeah.
And
I can see a 3-inch stack right there. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's all in there in the machine, but you can't see it there.
No, of course not. I was noticing some books over in the out of the corner of my eye.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are books for sure that I'm using, but anyway, it's this has been not only a matter of learning different ways to write, but learning different ways to write is also to learn different ways to think.
True.
And what we have always tried to do is to try to understand the world in ways that we can place ourselves in it. We place ourselves in relationship to being, in relationship to nature, in relationship to the divine, in relationship to ourselves, I mean, as a universal category, and also in relationship to history, and a flow of history, and it seems to me that from what I know of it, and the Poetics of the Common Knowledge is really an attempt to understand that history and see where what it means and what it comes to. It seems to me that that at this point that history needs to be forgotten, almost entirely, except perhaps as a kind of entertainment. Mm. You can go to the Metropolitan Museum and look around, and there's some really crazy and wonderful stuff there. And but to have any sense that here now, 2019, that offers us any kind of an answer, I think, is probably hopeful thinking. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do there's one simple thing that has to be done, and that is that everyone has to act So the next time they act, there are more ways to act. Always act so there are more ways to act next time. If you don't, evolution runs out. If you use up more possibilities than you create, you're a dead duck. And the whole orientation of making this is, I mean, you've been very nervous about the fact that I've been saying bad things about poetry and bad things about art.
I'm nervous.
You've been not nervous. Yeah, you've been nervous.
It doesn't matter to me. You could say your vision is as good as anyone else's.
If we're going to get through this, we have now for at least 200 years, seriously, since the beginning of the 19th century, using up more possibilities than we've been creating. We've been creating a lot of possibilities. All of science, all of technology, all of art, and the art has been an important part of it, has been creating more and more possibilities. But we've been using up more possibilities than we've been making, despite the fact that we've been doing that. And if you look at the curve of almost any production, whether it's wealth or petroleum products or electronic components or poems or mathematical theories or whatever, anything that we are making, it's the curve goes along flat from the time it begins for a while, and then in the last very recent time, it's turned straight up. Straight up, so it doesn't just approach infinity, it's aimed for a spot that's way beyond infinity somewhere. This is also true of population, which is probably the core production that we're dealing with here. And you cannot live on a curve of, because the flip side of this curve is, you know, upside down, is the depletion of the resources, whatever they are. And the fundamental law of art, and I would include in this technology, politics, economics, all of the ways in which we shape our lives, and including even the way we approach, say, physics. Physics isn't something that's given there. We decide to go after it in a certain way. And we go after it in a certain way that tells us what it is that we are in. It doesn't give us a place in it at all. Actually, Einstein tries to give us a place, but it just means a place to stand and look. It doesn't give us a place to act. If art, poetry, painting, music, the creation of medicine, I mean, medicine is an imagination. You don't know what to do. You have to imagine something to do. And but you always act so there are more ways to act next time.
Yeah, and as new things develop, I mean, there's cause and effect as well. I mean, it's not just...
Oh, yeah, sure.
The medicine was driven by need.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, not all medicine, but, you know, to begin with. I mean...
Having spent a lot of time with the medical establishment over the last few years, I assure you it's pretty primitive.
So I just wanted to remind listeners that this is Poet Radio. Don Bird is my guest this month. And do you have the answer, Don?
I don't have it written out, no.
We can't... I mean, you just gave us a beautiful soliloquy there at the precipice.
I can give you that much of an answer. I don't know what the next step is. I mean, I know that's the principle. What I don't know is how you go about doing that.
Right, how you go about preserving some. Preserving yeah. some of the
so let me read a poem.
Potentials. What was the word you used? Not opportunities. Possibilities. But yeah, possibilities. All right. Well, we have to finish up soon. But let's finish with a good It's good to have you on the program. Great to hear your poems.
This is a poem entitled The First Message. It's in memory of my father. And literally, he did a, I mean, this is pretty much an account of a dream. The structure of it is, as a poem, is not part of the dream, maybe. These 3 years, I watched my hands become his. Hours pass in the stream of thinking. My hands are still. My hands are still becoming his hands. It's spring again, the third, since his hands were stilled. His hands were never still. And when he called, the conversation was hampered because neither of us could say death. Though we had no illusions, the subject of the conversation could not be stated. It was an awful game of courtesy. He would give me all the information I wanted as long as I could ask, and he could answer without saying death. And I said, "Do you get hungry?" And he said, "Yes, very hungry." And I said, "Do you sing?" And he said, "I get hungry." And I said, "What do you do day by day?" And he said, "I watch the waves break on the cliffs." And I said, "Do you have any religious instructions?" And he said, "Yes, watch the waves break on the cliffs." And I said, "What is your greatest joy?" And he said, "To watch the waves break on the cliffs." And I said, "I'm asking the wrong questions." And he said, "All of the questions are wrong." And I said, "I'm asking the wrong questions." And he said, "Are you hungry?" And I said, "I'm asking the wrong questions." And he said, "What do you do day by day?" And I said, "I get hungry." And he said, "I'm asking the wrong questions."
Beautiful.
Yeah, this is an anthology poem, I think. I mean, but it's, I mean, the point is that it's, we know what to do. I mean, we know what has to happen if we're going to continue. I mean, this, and it's an experiment in the complexity of human life, of human intelligence.
Right.
I mean, that's, I mean, the thing that, you know, when I objected to, you know, when I said spiritual life, I mean, what I'm really committed to is the continued evolution of earthly intelligence, complex earthly intelligence. And that's what I think art is, and politics, and the business of life.
I think we have to, that may be a nice ending point for this discussion, at least for the purposes of the radio. Hopefully we have listeners tuning in who perhaps, if someone wants to, say someone wanted to get in touch with you, you have a presence anywhere online?
I'm on Facebook.
All right, Don Bird.
Twitter.
That does it for the radio program and Poet Radio. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM in Acre, Catskill, Hudson.